Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today I'm joined by Chidim Chetum, who is author of In the Street, Democratic Action, Theatricality, and Political Friendship. This was published by Oxford University Press in 2021. This is a really fascinating and sophisticated analysis of thinking about political protests, current ones and past ones, and how they fit into our understanding of democratic theory and democracy in general, with a side component of how they also integrate and consider strangers meeting and how that is a component of what we might consider to be political friendship, perhaps defined by Aristotle. But I'm going to have Chidim tell us all about that. First, I would like to welcome Chidim to the podcast and ask her to tell us a little bit about herself and how she came to this particular project. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Lily. Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure. It's wonderful to be able to talk about my work. I came to this topic as a part of my dissertation work, but perhaps this was the issue of political protest and political action has been the central thing that made me interested in political theory in the first place. I think it was in my senior year in college when I first read Hannah Arendt and when she talks about the joy and gratification of acting together. That was the thing that got me hooked in political theory and in study of political protest and political action. So since then, of course, a lot has happened. One of the other turning points was the Gezi protests that took place in Turkey in 2013. Pure luck would have it that I was there at the time. I did not engage in participatory observation, but I was there in the protests. And that changed the way I see things in rather important ways, as it did for many people who participated in those events as well. So it is partially the ongoing interest all the way from my graduate school years combined with this personal, deeply affecting experience that made me think about how we talk about democratic action, how we talk about democratic spontaneous moments, and in what ways the way we talk about those events can lead to the erasure of the emancipatory dimensions of those events. So those were the questions that emerged partially from my experience during the events and in the aftermath when people started writing and talking about
them. And so you set up the book, and it's really interesting because the reader enters the book through your description in a kind of foreword of these aesthetic images that that you sort of draw back and forwards from the protests in Turkey, in 2013 to the protests in France in 1968 to protest in France in the French Revolution. And so that the image has sort of gone through a number of different iterations. And this is the reader's entry point into your discussion of political protests and political theory. So I would love for you to explain how this particular folding in on this image of beauty in the streets, I think, is important to start our thinking on this context of democratic action and political protest.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I mean, it is the image that you're talking about is a stencil that I came across as I was looking for the street art that emerged during the protests. And the stencil, it is also in the cover of the book. So the stencil is the image of this ominous-looking gas-masked figure, and underneath it, it says in Turkish, "Chemical Tayyip," referring to Recep Tayyip Erdoğan, the president, then prime minister of Turkey, and making this allusion to chemical warfare in order to criticize the police violence that was taking place at the time during the protests. But what really got me excited and interested in the image, I mean, the image itself is really powerful, but what really got me excited was that there is this fragment of a sentence on top of it that looks as if it is there by mistake, because it is in French, above all. Why do we have a French fragment of a sentence on an Istanbul street? So the fragment says, "Dans la rue," and it means "is in the street." And of course, that is that turns out to be a section of an iconic May 68 poster that has this figure of woman throwing a cobblestone, and it says, "The beauty is in the street." And I try to look into how that image was picked up in this current constellation in Turkey. And the image itself is, of course, harkening back, as you suggested, to a painting from 1860s in terms of the French Revolution. So it shows us in a rather fascinating way how protesters take these, what Walter Benjamin calls tiger's leap into the past, and link these chronologically distant events by linking the hopes and desires of those people who created those moments of action. And one of the concerns that the book tries to deal with is that Benjamin says, for such constellations to occur, we have to have a record of those events. And for that reason, he says, he calls the theorist, the historian, the theorist, to brush history against the grain so as to rescue the past uprisings from official accounts that either tone down their subversive dimensions or erase their presence from collective memory. And it's that is the kind of effort that I'm trying to take make in this book as a way to brush history against the grain so as to keep a record of the hopes and desires of these people who enacted these moments of democratic action so that we can have a record of those events and they can be picked up later on in the future. That's what Benjamin calls fanning the spark of hope in the past, and that is the kind of exercise that I'm trying to engage in this book.
And one of the points that you make as you're sort of traveling through not only how Jean-Jacques Rousseau thought about sort of emancipatory struggles and public protests, but as you sort of put Rousseau in an encounter in a certain sense with three more contemporary theorists who also all experienced the events of 1968, is that you sort of talk about the flattening of history and the flattening of our understanding of these kinds of revolutionary experiences, events, the uprisings in 68, the uprising in Tahrir Square, the Gizeh protests in Turkey and elsewhere, that a lot of the time these events are sort of, in historical perspective, made simple. How is it that the sort of protests should be considered?
Yes, that is an excellent question, and that is the goal that I'm trying to achieve, to come up with a new conceptual framework where we can actually keep a record of those diverse, creative, innovative practices of these actors. And this is one of the issues that I have been having since perhaps the Occupy Wall Street or the Arab Spring, the revolutionary struggle in Tahrir Square, etc. Because one of the most telling shared aspects of those debates that emerge in the aftermath of significant moments of popular action, and we can add the protests that started in 2020, for instance, after the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, is that on the one hand, commentators, and when I say commentators, I include both the scholars of protest, democratic theorists, but also pundits in the mainstream media. What I see there is, on the one hand, they all praise the spontaneity, which they equate with the absence of organizational efforts and the festive atmosphere and the irreducible diversity of the protesters. On the other hand, and almost in the same breath, the same commentators take issue with the participants' alleged inability of organization, inability to organize. They warn the protesters that in the absence of meaningful political organization, such revolts are going to fail. They will remain as mere revolts, never turn into long-lasting political change. And I think that what we end up with is a set of debates that remain trapped in these binaries and between success and failure. So our debate is shaped by what it would take for these people to succeed in bringing about long-lasting change, and also in a fruitless debate regarding the relative virtues of spontaneity and organization. And I suggest that when we are trapped in those debates, and what we lose is, and I turn to Kristen Ross for this, and she takes this notion of working existence of democracy from Marx. What we lose is a sight of the working existence of democracy. In other words, the actions, the on-the-ground efforts of political actors who create these events against all odds. And I wonder, how can we understand the erasure of such practices from all these different accounts? And my answer to that question is that I think that erasure goes to the heart of democratic theory itself. I trace that erasure, the reasons behind that erasure, back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau's theorization of popular sovereignty and his account of popular sovereignty as the immediate expression of popular will. So I suggest that this shared conception of democratic action, which casts organization as a technical matter that precedes politics, and moments of spontaneous action as sudden explosions, repeat a Rousseauian tendency to think of democratic action as the immediate and direct expression of people's will. And when they do that, they also bring in some of the problematic tendencies in Rousseau's work. So I can talk about that, or we can move to another place. I'll leave it.
Well, I was going to ask you for why it is that Rousseau's the bad guy, because you sort of set up the book that Rousseau is somewhat problematic for our thinking about popular protest. And so I would love for you to go into at least a bit of an overview as to why he is this problematic theorist in regard to democratic agitation, and sort of why his sort of focus on the question of immediacy, as you tease out of his work, is really at the heart of the responses to how he's cast a long shadow in our thinking about popular engagement and popular protest in the street.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, of course, Rousseau is a central figure for democratic theory, especially the kind of democratic theory that emphasizes participation, participatory politics. And yet, I want to say that there is the same kind of oscillation that we see in the contemporary debates in Rousseau's work itself. On the one hand, Rousseau makes it clear that popular sovereignty is about the direct rule of the people. And he argues that liberty is writing the laws that you make, obeying the laws that you make yourself. On the other hand, and almost in the same breath, Rousseau is deeply suspicious of people's ability to govern themselves without the guidance of some sort of a figure. So I see that oscillation between this confidence and emphasis on people's capacity to govern themselves and the suspicion regarding their ability to do so as one of the foundational paradoxes of Rousseau's thought. And what I try to show, and I argue that this is the long shadow, is that Rousseau wants to emphasize that popular sovereignty relies on the immediate presence of citizens in the assemblies. And yet he's also deeply suspicious that that immediate presence, if it is left to its own devices, will result in actions that will lead to decisions that will be interest of the community as a whole. And one of the things that he does to deal with that is to ensure that there is no mediation within the assembly. So as many figures like Michel Foucault and Habermas himself talks about, the assembly in Rousseau's account is a unity of hearts rather than minds. Rousseau makes clear that there is no deliberation in the assembly. We have to be there in full presence without entering into any intermediating practices, mediation with one another, because that risks clouding the possibility of reaching the common goal, which should reside in people's hearts as in their capacity as citizens. So there is that aspect. And then, of course, Rousseau is also concerned that such moments of action are short-lived. They cannot sustain themselves over a long period of time. And the solution that he comes up with is to ensure that these assemblies are periodic assemblies, so they can be periodically enacted in order to ensure the sustainability of the state. So there are those concerns that animate Rousseau's view, which also require the guidance of some sort of an authority figure in the form of a legislator, as he talks about in On the Social Contract. So I see these interesting aspects in Rousseau's thought being repeated in the accounts of contemporary theorists, even in those contemporary theorists who are especially careful to not reproduce some of the problems that they see in Rousseau's own account, such as signing onto a notion of a macro subject, as Habermas would put it, with a single will, etc. And how do I see that? Well, I suggest that when we think about democratic moments of political action as these sudden instantaneous events, these explosions, the commentators seem to reduce spontaneous protests to the immediate and authentic expression of protesters who seem to be acting as a unified subject. And I say that because the word spontaneous, which comes from the Latin sua ponte, sponte, means of one's own accord. And it can mean immediacy only when action is undertaken by a subject with a single will. And so it seems to me that it's no surprise that when commentators equate spontaneity to immediacy, they end up with these accounts that erase the rich and varied practices of diverse political actors. And the second issue is that it seems to me that by construing the transience of spontaneous action as a sign of its failure, and considering democratic moments' unpredictability as a shortcoming, many of these commentators, theorists, follow in Rousseau's footsteps. And in doing so, and perhaps this is the most outrageous and claim when we talk about someone like Rancière, for instance, but they produced a deeply anti-democratic Rousseauian understanding of the role of the intellectual in politics, which defines it, I say, in strictly educational forms. In other words, in this account, the task of the theorist is charged. The task of the theorist is to tell the actors on the ground what their goals really are, how they should act if they are to bring about a long-lasting change, etc. And I see there that move that I see in Rousseau, which is on the one hand valorizing the immediate action of the people, but then having the suspicious with regard to their ability to govern themselves.
And so this is the tension that you see in Rousseau and this oscillation back and forth, particularly with regard to this question of the puncturing nature of sort of political protest or political sort of vocal political action, is where you then have these interlocutors, these much more contemporary interlocutors, come in and you analyze them in taking on Rousseau and thinking about sort of this democratic action problem, and also thinking about the democratic action as what it might produce, the outcome, as opposed to the democratic action for its own purpose. And this is, again, where we get to this question of what is the goals of the organizing of the democratic action. So can you go over the three key theorists that you sort of put in conversation with Rousseau on this topic?
Sure, of course. So what I do in the book is an attempt to counter this Rousseauian influence and this what I call hold of immediacy on our democratic thought by doing two things. First, I appropriate Aristotle's notion of political friendship so as to bring to light what is otherwise erased in these accounts, namely those practices, what I call intermediating practices, that enable different people, erstwhile strangers, to work together. And bring that conception of political friendship and in order to create an alternative conceptual framework that emphasizes theatricality of democratic action, which I take largely from Jacques Rancière's account. So to do that, to come up with this alternative conceptual framework, as you suggested, I critically engage with and build on the works of three contemporary democratic theorists, Antonio Negri, Jürgen Habermas, and Jacques Rancière. who all formulated their own radically different conceptualizations of democracy in the aftermath of yet another major democratic uprising, that is the uprisings of 1968. And while their experiences were filtered through the circumstances of their countries in which they lived, and 68 takes many different forms in different countries, and also while they were coming from different Marxist traditions, autonomous Marxism in Negri's account, Frankfurt School in Habermas's, and Althusserian Marxism in Rancière's account, all these thinkers writing in Italy, Germany, and France took similar journeys that carried them away from their earlier Marxist positions and moved them towards democratic theory. And they did so while trying to answer questions that we are also trying to answer in the aftermath of these important moments of democratic action. Questions such as, can spontaneous uprisings ever lead to institutional change, or are they bound to dissipate without creating a permanent effect? And what accounts for the elusiveness of such moments of collective action? What prevented the protesters from coming up with a coherent list of demands? I mean, we hear this all the time. Also questions such as, who is the subject of these events? And what role should we as intellectuals play in the face of such unexpected moments of democratic action? So it seems to me that all these theorists address these questions in their work. And Negri, and what I do in each of these accounts is to offer some historical background with regard to the kind of political, with regard to explaining the political interventions that these theorists are engaging in each of these chapters. So, for instance, Negri tried to convince his Marxist colleagues that neither multiplicity of struggles, which characterized the vibrant political field in Italy during the early 1970s, nor the diversity of political actors were a revolutionary, were a roadblock to revolutionary politics. I mean, this was one of the central issues that were going on in the autonomous Marxist circles at the time, in terms of, are we losing sight of what constitutes the real struggle? Are we having too many people saying too many things? And Negri, I think, in a really significant way, stands up to those criticisms and says, no, it is actually important that we have diverse political actors, we have diverse concerns. So what he did was to challenge the Marxist orthodoxy's attachment to the idea that a narrowly defined working class can become the subject of revolution. And he tried to broaden the scope of the revolutionary subject by introducing a number of notions, including the social worker and the multitude, to have an open and inclusive concept, to highlight the emancipatory potential of these diverse actors. And this is where I see the resurgence of Rousseauian emphasis on immediacy. Despite this crucial effort to rethink revolutionary democratic action for Negri, they are one and the same, especially in later Negri. Negri continued to share his colleagues' view that the transience of popular uprisings is a sign of their failure. So even in the most recent works that he co-authored with Michael Hart, Negri seems to be concerned that the political organization of the multitude is necessary, that the immediacy of the democratic event does not become an obstacle to revolution. So the immediacy, which he valorizes, also becomes an issue later on. So that's Negri's way of reintroducing Rousseauian problems in his work. And in certain ways, that is an easy case because Negri insists that democratic action has to be immediate and direct. In Habermas, I see a different kind of resurgence of Rousseauian influence. And that, again, has its roots in Habermas's engagement with the political events of his time during the 1968. Habermas's engagement with the debates that emerged in the German context following the 1968, I believe, led him to question the insistence to construe the transience of democratic action as failure. So instead, Habermas embraces the fragility of events as a guarantee against their calcification into bureaucratized movements, where the radical content of spontaneous associations are inevitably curtailed and new inequalities are created to meet organizational demands. I mean, the criticism that Habermas provides towards organizations is almost similar to Sheldon Wolin's account of organizations in terms of how they inject the sense of expertise and create this inequality, etc. So Habermas, I think, is unique in the sense that he emphasizes the wild and anarchic, and those are direct quotes from Habermas's Between Facts and Norms, wild and anarchic moments of spontaneous action that constitute the radical core of deliberative democracy. And yet, and here is the Rousseauian resurgence, I think, while he emphasizes the democratic moment's unrestricted quality, Habermas is also wary of the possibility that they can go out of hand in certain ways. And he, it seems to me, tries to address that concern by finding ways to constrain the unpredictability of democratic action. And in doing so, I suggest, and I see this especially in his discussions on civil disobedience from 1980s, where he insists that moments of spontaneous action that deserve a tolerant attitude from the state requires the participants to have an attachment to the constitutional principles. And in that move, I see this risk of turning political theory into a disciplinary mechanism whereby the theorist takes on the authority figure, role of the authority figure, charged with guiding democratic action. One of the things that Habermas insists in 1980s, for instance, is that the protesters should not have reference to the basic law's emphasis on resistance, and instead focus on and formulate their term dissent in terms of civil disobedience. So that is very interesting and unique because Habermas is especially careful in terms of saying that the philosopher, the political theorist, should not take on that role of trying to guide political movements because philosopher doesn't have this unique access to the truth. So he's very, very careful on that regard. In that regard, and yet, even in his account, I think it is possible to see something to this effect. So that issue takes me to Rancière, whose work shapes the book to a large extent, I believe. I'm very much influenced by his work. And one of the questions that shaped his political theory is this question of authority and the role of the political theorist. Rancière discusses this notion, especially after 1968, following his mentor Louis Althusser's rather dismissive account of the events, which become more dismissive as time goes by, whereby he calls the protests as a petty bourgeois uprising, which was bound to fail due to the protesters' class position. Especially in response to that reaction, Rancière begins to think about how leftist political thinkers discuss these democratic moments and suggest that perhaps what we see here is an example of what he calls the transformation of political theory into what he calls a theory of education. And he suggests that that was perhaps the most significant problem that plagued the debates in the aftermath of May 68. And in his early writings, trying to find a way out from this tendency, Rancière argued or called for the theorists to give up on their desire to control and shape the events that are going on around them, and suggested that perhaps far from a shortcoming to be resolved, the unpredictability that gives so much anxiety to certain theorists is an essential aspect of democratic politics. And to underline that point, I argue that this is perhaps a decidedly anti-Rousseauian turn. He emphasized the theatrical aspect of democratic action. So according to him, taking a role other than who they are supposed to be, imitating others and acting as if they are a part in a given social order in which they have no part, political actors stage their equality in democratic events. And I think that is a uniquely anti-Rousseauian account because, as I try to show in my chapter on Rousseau, Rousseau's conception of democratic action as the immediate expression of people's will is largely shaped through his criticism of the theater and its claim to be an institution of political and moral education during 1800s, during 18th centuries, late 1700s. So in that sense, Rancière is central to the project, but I think there is truth in some of the criticisms that are directed to Rancière as well. Many critics of Rancière have argued that he ignores the collective work that goes into the creation of such stagings of equality. Peter Hallward calls this a blindness towards group dynamics in his account. There seems to be a focus on moments of self-emancipation, as in the case of Proletarian Knights and the Ignorant Schoolmaster. And as such, many theorists, I believe, rightly argued that he opens himself to the charge of limiting political activity to immediate acts of negation. And in that sense, even in his account, it is possible to see this resurgence of Rousseauian emphasis on immediacy that hounds Habermas's and Negri's conceptions. So it is with that in mind, given that even such nuanced accounts seem to erase the crucial emancipatory dimensions of democratic action, that is to say, the varied and innovative practices of democratic actors, I suggest that what we need perhaps is an alternative conception, and the linchpin of that alternative conception in my account is Aristotle's notion of political friendship.
And so that's where I wanted to take you next. because as I was reading along in the book, I'm like, huh, this is a little bit of an interesting swerve here, because this is not exactly where I thought we were going to go. But as I read your work on thinking about Aristotle's conception of political friendship and how this is to some degree the antidote, if you will, to some of the problems with the contemporary theorists as well as with Rousseau around our understanding of democratic action and popular uprisings, that there is something that happens among people who are involved in these uprisings that is important and that is in a certain sense capturable, that I started to come round to the swerve. And so I would love for you to explain about how you saw this, you know, sort of not retreat, but move backwards to move forwards, to go back to the ancients, in particular Aristotle, who does spend so much time, both Aristotle and Plato and Socrates spend so much time on this concept of friendship and understanding political friendship, and how this really feeds into some ways that we can think about political action and protest.
Yes, thank you. Yes, and it is. I used to say, and in order to make this conceptual turn, I'm going to turn to an unexpected source, Aristotle, and he is unexpected. Yes, exactly. Given that, especially my focus is on contemporary thinkers. Even though I suggest that the problem, the source of the problem, goes to Rousseau. But I think Aristotle is especially important because there is, I mean, if you, this is another aspect of contemporary debates that I find somewhat troubling, in the sense that there are these notions of how these political actors almost suddenly come together and all the differences melt away, and you have this affective unity that deals with all these disagreements, etc. And I want to emphasize that there is a crucial role for emotions in these events, such as anger, indignation, rage, and also joy, etc. I was looking for finding a way to think about those without necessarily coming to this notion of an immediate sudden change that emanates from some sort of an emotional discharge, I believe that's Jody Dean talks about that emotional discharge when she talks about crowds. And I think Aristotle helps me to bring those things together while emphasizing the importance of practices. And this is the reason why Aristotle is such an important figure for me. And of course, I mean, political friendship is a very contested concept within the literature on Aristotle as well, because he doesn't say much about it. It briefly emerges in certain sections of the text in Nicomachean Ethics. And so what I do is I draw on the existing literature, especially this recent move against the communitarian appropriation of the concept, which presents it as a strong sense of attachment that generates a kind of moral unity. And most contemporary theorists of Aristotle, and here I turn to people like Bernard Yak, Jill Frank, Daniel Allen, etc., they emphasize that political friendship is a kind of shared advantage friendship. It's a friendship that holds citizens together by the expectation of a return of some good for the good that they do for another. In that sense, political friendship is very different from an emotional attachment. Aristotle himself states that political friendship is different from the kind of friendship that you would have between comrades and kindreds, since he says, unlike those kind of friendship, this one relies on compact and agreement. As an agreement, what is necessary in political friendship is that one has to come to an agreement as to what they hold in common. So while brothers and comrades hold everything in common, Aristotle writes, fellow voyagers and citizens share certain definite things, and it is by coming to an agreement of what they hold in common that they become friends. So in that sense, reaching an agreement of this kind involves choice, but unlike the act of choosing something on the spur of a moment, this particular act of choosing requires people to engage in deliberation, contestation, judging, and understanding. And it is those activities that I call intermediating practices that relate people to one another in different ways. And it is also those practices that enable me to come up with a notion of unity that does not erase the constant existence of disagreements and disputes among protesters. It also emphasizes the importance that such kind of coming together of this kind cannot last forever, because it requires the constant effort, constant practices of the political actors. But it also makes it clear that the transience of such moments is not a part of their failure, but is something that is essential to them. And in thinking about political friendship in these ways, I also think that we can see that emphasis on purity, that risk of turning these events into romanticized notions of immediate harmony, etc. I think political friendship serves as an antidote to that kind of thinking as well. Because Aristotle makes clear what you have here is an instrumental relation to a certain extent. You're giving something with the expectation of something in return. And that means that you're bound to have disputes and disagreements. And it's the messiness of that kind of relationship is a central aspect of democratic action itself. And that way, I suggest what we see is that one of the points that Rancière makes is to say that those moments of disruption that he sees in the distribution of the sensible in those moments of democratic events, he said these are one-off moments, and as such they can't be extended, because the moment you try to extend them, you find yourself in need of creating new social bonds, etc. And with those kind of new social bonds, you create new inequalities and new kinds of exclusions. And my response through Aristotle's political friendship is that yes, that is indeed true. And perhaps as democratic theorists, we should not ignore the fact that even the most egalitarian moments create those kind of exclusions and inequalities. And that is, that kind of messiness and impurity is a part of democratic action itself. And that should not take away us from seeing the crystallization and hope of hopes and desires of these people who create this new way of being, seeing, and acting in those moments of democratic action.
And I just wanted to ask you one more point to sort of unpack and put together in context of our understanding of the role of democratic friendship within the scope of not only the democratic ideas or theories, but also this turn towards action, is the point that you brought up and that you raise in terms of Rancière's disagreement with Rousseau over theater and theatricality, and that the place where individuals actually perform their equality is in this zone of essentially political friendship, I think. Can you sort of explain that just a little bit more?
Yes, of course. That's an excellent question. Yes, that's an important part that I skipped. So thank you for asking that. Yes, so what I say is that, yes, on the one hand, we have to come to terms with the fact that political friendship refers to an instrumental relation insofar as it is an advantage friendship. To the extent that it is friendship, it involves a verification of equality here and now. So political friends, I argue, who are vastly different from one another in terms of their habits, skills, excellence, as Aristotle puts it, bring in those different habits and dispositions to contribute in equal terms to the common that they themselves constitute. And I suggest that they also rule and are ruled in turn. And I think that is especially important, that reciprocal activity of ruling is especially important in understanding the significance of innovative resistance practices that we have been seeing in various democratic events, such as the creation of horizontal networks, where taking turns had become the organizing principle, or practices of property like common use that turned that turn equality into what Rancière calls a verifiable fact rather than a future agenda that is a goal that is set in the future. And it seems to me that what we can see is both the egalitarian aspect of democratic action as a result through the conceptual of conceptual lens of political friendship, and also the impurity and messiness of democratic events by being attuned to the inequalities, exclusions that are created as a result of the creation of this kind of a relationship. But it seems to me that what is being erased in all these other accounts of democratic action that discuss them in terms of sudden explosions, immediate reactions of people, the rash, and in certain ways sometimes called as irrational reactions of the people, is the very existence of contestation, deliberation, judging, coming up with practices like common use, even practices like artistic production that relate these people, these erstwhile strangers, and in that sense, ensure that they begin to relate to one another through the mediation of these practices themselves.
And so now that you have completed what is a fascinating and complex analysis of protests and democratic theory, and you've put many, many political theorists in conversation with one another in very fascinating ways, what is it that you're working on now?
That's a very good question. Yes. I think one of the things, and this is how I end the book as well, is the question of remembrance. In other words, how do we remember events such as these? How do we struggle against the efforts by the powers that be, and in Turkey that is the current authoritarian rule, under the leadership of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, how can we struggle against the efforts of the powers that be to erase the collective memory of events such as these? I think this took especially a dire turn in Turkey. I mean, Erdogan was trying to trivialize the events from the very beginning. So he first called the events during as the events were unfolding, he called the protesters as a bunch of vandals destroying things. Then he called them a group of middle-class activists who don't understand the real concerns of the real people, which is in somehow repeated in certain leftist accounts. And I think that is something that we have to think about carefully. And then after the end of the events, I think perhaps in an unwitting recognition of the enormity of what has happened, he began to call them the events as a coup attempt to overthrow the government. And that claim was taken to its extreme by an effort to literally put Gezi protests on trial by putting a number of activists on trial for organizing to overthrow the government and organizing the protests in order to overthrow the government. So the outcome of that trial was declared on April 25, almost a month earlier. The court sentence one of the activists for a life sentence and seven others to 18 years of prison sentence. When I see that kind of a direct political attempt to erase what has happened and to rewrite history, I begin to think about the importance of keeping a record of the past that Benjamin calls flits by, to keep a true record of that. And I wonder what it takes to do that. So my most recent work is focusing on that issue, and not only to keep a record of the protests and the unrealized hopes and desires of the people who enacted those protests, but also most recently, for instance, the government's attempt to crash Kurdish resistance in the southern part of Turkey. And there I especially look at these images that were released by special operations units as a way to further humiliate the Kurdish population there. And I try to read those images as a way to show what they are trying to do and in what ways reading those images in a different way can undermine that attempt to tell a particular story of what has happened. So that's the new project, looking at the images and interpreting them in ways so that we can ensure that the memory of resistance is not erased by the powers that
or flattened, as you talk about throughout the book.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, I hope that you'll come back and speak to me about that book when you finish it, because it sounds fascinating.
Thank you.
I would probably learn more about Turkish history as a result. because I don't know a lot about it, I will admit. But I do want to thank you today, Cidem Çudum, for joining me to talk about In the Street, Democratic Action, Theatricality, and Political Friendship, published by Oxford University Press in 2021. I assume one can purchase this book at the Oxford University Press website. Is there a local brick and mortar store to which you would like to give a shout out?
That totally caught me off guard. No, not that I can think of right now.
That's no problem. We'll just direct people to the Oxford University Press website to pick up your book. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about it today.
Yes, thank you so much. And thank you so much for the excellent, amazing questions.
My pleasure.